sitting practice together, and then have a short break, and then offer a little talk on, and maybe some discussion on self-refuge, learning what that is and how it works and how to manifest it in the way we do our practice together. So let's start off, as we do, by doing some sitting practice together. And as we do our practice, since I'll be talking about refuge a little bit afterwards, there are ways that you can work with breathing practice when you're sitting that can also help get in touch with a place of inner refuge. So for me, when I reflect on what it means to be in a place of refuge, like when you're doing metaphrases for yourself, one of the most common metaphrases is, may I live with ease and know ease of well-being. May I be safe from all inner and outer harm. So sometimes for me, when I'm feeling really at ease and expansive and the sun is shining and whatnot, then I feel as if when I'm settling back into a meditative state, that just being in this, in natural surroundings, in this relaxed state is sort of refuge enough. Other times, for whatever reason, when the mind is in a different state, then for me, refuge can take on sort of quite a different meaning or a different aspect. So, don't know how many of you may have seen the award-winning nature film, you know, My Octopus Teacher, where this diver goes down to the same place in the same kelp forest off the South African Cape every day for a year throughout the life cycle of this female octopus that he's following, and he kind of befriends, and they develop this sort of relationship. And the octopus, the way they make their living, and the way most animals do, whether in the ocean or terrestrial ones, there's something in animal behavior and ethology, a concept called refuge and prospect. And what that means is that all animal species, whether predator or prey, tend to try to find surroundings, a place to be, a habitat, okay, that offers both refuge and prospect. Refuge, in this case, meaning a place of safety from which they can view their surroundings. So prospect means being able to see what's around you, to take it all in. And refuge means being able to do it from a place of safety. Okay. And so in the case of the octopus in this film, her refuge was this crevice in an undersea rock formation that she could slither her body into and get way back deep into, where no potential predators, especially the pajama sharks that like to eat octopuses, were able to get at her. But she could still see out. So she could check out and make sure there weren't any sharks around, and then she could scoot out and get something to eat. And then when things got rough, she could scoot back into her refuge again. So sometimes for me, for, I don't know, brain chemistry, whatever's going on, sometimes when I'm feeling a little anxious or some feeling of foreboding or misgiving or whatever, when I'm not feeling all expansive and light and one with nature, then under those occasions, for me, being in a place of refuge means kind of drawing in and sinking down, almost going, allowing the consciousness to become smaller and smaller in a great vast field that gradually becomes more still and more quiet as I breathe into that space. So in fact, in one of the jhanas, one of the meditative absorptions, the fourth jhana is a place of deep meditative stillness. So sometimes, just through breathing practice, I find it possible to go there, and you can play with this evening. So with each in-breath, you can imagine sort of the vastness of the open space around you or whatever, you know, if you want to imagine like the octopus being, you know, in this kelp forest and the ocean. Just taking it all in with each in-breath, and then with each out-breath, it's like sinking even more deeply into the quiet, still place of safety and ease, and almost to the point of non-being, right? And so you can allow the breathing, especially each out-breath, to just allow the consciousness to settle even deeper into this space of stillness, of quiet, and coming. So should you wish to do so, as we do our practice tonight, then I can offer that imagery. And then, please excuse, I'm going to get something to clear my throat in a minute. And then, to the extent you wish to do so, you can keep working with that imagery as we do our practice. And then at some point, if you would just like, you can just let it go and, you know, just watch the arising and passing of phenomena. And then whenever you wish, you can come back to that imagery and allow the consciousness, the mind, to sink even deeper into this still quiet place. Okay, so let's do some sitting, so we'll have something to talk about after we do so. But please find a sitting posture that is a comfort and a kindness to your body, right? Whether you're sitting in a chair or on a couch, maybe on a bench or a cushion on the floor, just settle in and allow the body to become more at ease, more relaxed, more centered. Okay. Yet checking to make sure that your posture is such that you can remain upright, you know, with your head up and your shoulders back, so the energy can continue to flow through the mind-body process. Mm-hmm. And your arms relaxed at your sides, your hands folded in your lap, allowing the eyes to gently close, and the attention to come to rest on the breathing. Whether you notice it mostly as the air moving in and out of the nostrils, or maybe the rising and falling of the abdomen, like the surface of the ocean on a calm day. Mm-hmm. the vast space around you, like the ocean, limitless. And with each out-breath, imagine that the consciousness is sinking into a quiet, still, protected, safe place within this vastness. With each out-breath, going a little more deeply into this space. Opening to the vastness with each in-breath, and then sinking more deeply into the quiet, still, safe place for the consciousness to abide with each out-breath. As you gradually feel your consciousness moving steadily and gently, more deeply to the center, the still, quiet, empty center that is the abode of non-being. Allowing the mind to become progressively more relaxed, more at ease, floating into the still, silent place of refuge. A place where all is well, all is calm, where the mind is at ease. With nothing to do, nowhere to go, and no one to be. Is clear. Can you remain unmoving until the right action arises by itself? You need not seek fulfillment, not seeking, not expecting. You can be present and welcome all things. So, let's take a short break and get back together again for some announcements and a talk and some discussion. still working on my throat. So we have this time set aside for announcements of any upcoming Sangha or other Dharma-related activities that anyone knows about, they may want to share. So, anything anyone has to offer?
So, I posted the usual info in the chat section, and I thought I would try this. And that's Tara Lloyd's retreat.
Very good.
July 8th.
That's a residential retreat. Their RMERC is asking for proof of vaccination for anyone who'd like to attend. To the extent the weather allows, most of our sittings and Dharma talks and chanting and whatnot is going to happen outdoors in a circle, although meals are going to be offered inside. And it begins on late Thursday afternoon, runs through Sunday afternoon. So if you'd like more information about it, if you think you might be interested, then please, by all means, get in touch with me individually, or unless you have any questions now that you'd like to raise. Okay, and in tandem with that, we have our Queer Sangha support group that meets on the second and fourth Thursday evenings of every month at 7:30 on this link. So we're meeting this this coming Thursday evening, and we'll be looking at the question of the importance of having an authentic sense of self and identity on the one hand, and the Buddha's teaching that eventually all identities must be relinquished. How do we hold those two things? How do we balance those understandings? So that's what we'll be up to for those who may want to join us then. Thanks, Kathleen. Anything else anyone would like to share? Okay, I'll be sipping this drink off and on while I talk, just to keep my throat clear. I have to. So, being and doing. We've been sitting in on Gil Fronsdale's 8 a.m. Morning sits on the mornings that I'm not teaching myself. And this last week, the last time he taught, he was paying particular attention to this balance and this gradual transformation that occurs over the time that we start doing meditation practice and Dharma study. And he discusses it or frames it as the transition from doing to being. So when we first take up meditation practice, the way the mind works, the way the discursive mind has been trained to work throughout our lives is, you know, it's like learning a new skill, learning the multiplication tables, learning how to ride a bicycle, learning how to do anything that requires cognitive effort. It's about focusing on the task, acquiring the requisite skills, and then putting them into use. It's very sort of active. In the Taoist sense, it's quite yang in nature, assertive, active, making things happen, making a difference in the world. And then gradually, with the maturation of practice, there becomes less emphasis on doing, or an understanding that maybe the doing of things, the learning about the learning mindfulness of breath, learning of mindfulness of the body, the learning of mindfulness of this, that, and the other thing. The learning of the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas, the learning of cultivation of deep meditative states, gradually become to be seen as a kind of a means to an end. But the end does not consist of going from A to B. It consists of going within. So, like a little bit like what we're doing during our sit, it was an exercise in not doing anything, right? Except gathering in and becoming more and more relaxed and engaging in non-doing as a way of coming up on the edge of, or touching, or coming at least into the neighborhood of non-being. So the Buddha, like a lot of these things, he actually had a parable for this. And it's the parable of the ancient forest. It's found in the Samyutta Nikaya. Said, suppose a wanderer in the forest would see an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. He would follow it and would see an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks and groves and ponds and ramparts. A delightful place. Then the man would go and inform the king or royal minister, know that when wandering through the forest, I saw an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. I followed it and saw an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks and groves and ponds and ramparts, a delightful place. Sire, you should renovate this city so that all may enjoy it. And the royal minister would renovate the city, and sometime later that city would become successful and prosperous, well populated, filled with people, and attained to growth and expansion. So too, monks, I saw the ancient path, the ancient road traveled by the perfectly enlightened ones of the past. And what is that road? It is just this. The Eightfold Path, leading to a place of refuge. I followed that path, and by doing so, I have directly known aging and death, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation. So the way he describes it, there was a period of doing, you know, following this path into the forest. And then there was a discovery. So the way the Buddha describes his teachings is not as something that he invented or that he brought into being or that he made up of whole cloth. He talks of it as if it was, he speaks of it, his experience of it as a discovery, as coming across something that was there all along, just sort of waiting to be unearthed. So if you go to an archaeological dig, for instance, you don't see a lot of bulldozers and backhoes. Because they would destroy that which you're trying to discover. Instead, you see this pit, and there are all these people down there stepping around carefully, and they have little hand trowels, and they have these sieves where they take the earth from really carefully blocked out cubic meters of earth and then sift through them real carefully so they can find out what was in each place. And then a little bit by little bit, they can pull these artifacts into a picture of what this place was like, who lived there, what tools they used, how it was. So it's just like that, as the Buddha describes, the discovery of the Dharma. So when he teaches, he's teaching something he discovered. And the way he taught it, said, this ancient city that I discovered, okay, that I found within my own consciousness, that I found within myself, is within you as well. Okay? And I discovered my ancient city, and now it's for you to discover yours. Okay? So there is the effort of doing, but then once that doing has brought you to a certain place, at that point, it's about being. It's about being in this place of refuge where no further effort is required. The being there and the relaxing into that place allows for a mind state, a more passive may not be the right word, but allows for the opportunity to settle in and allow the Dharma to come to you. So like when Najan Chah, the Thai Force Meditation Master, would talk about, doing the mindfulness practice, you know, he used that really now well-known simile of allowing the mind to become like a clear forest pool, where, you know, like the passage I just read out of the Tao Te Ching, where you can gradually allow your mud to settle until things are seen with great clarity. Many strange and wondrous animals come to drink, as Ajahn Chah said. And occasionally fall and splash around a little bit and make things muddy again. So then you start it. Be that as it may, it's this dance between exerting a certain amount of effort and then just relaxing into that state of being within which any further action is informed by the stillness and the quiet. There are many translations of Lao Tzu's masterpiece, the Tao Te Ching. He was a contemporary of the Buddha, but many of the things that he wrote they were not in touch with each other, separated by thousands of miles. But many of the things he wrote at roughly the same time as the Buddha's teaching, a little later maybe, are extraordinary in their parallels to what the Buddha was teaching at the same time, especially the teachings on emptiness. So the literature of the Taoists, the Tao Te Ching, the teachings of Xuanzu, with these extraordinary parallels to Buddha Dharma, when the Buddhist missionaries started coming into China, it came in different waves. At first, they were regarded just as esoteric philosophers. But later on, there were other Buddhists who came into the country, most famously Bodhidharma, who didn't emphasize doctrine or philosophy. They emphasized bare attention, just doing the practice and seeing what arises. And that way of teaching Buddha Dharma got conjoined with Taoism and evolved into what was called Shuan Buddhism, Japanese translation of Shuan Buddhism, or Shuan is Zen. So Stephen Mitchell
is a translator of sacred texts, and he has a very well-regarded translation of the Tao Te Ching. His translations of the Tao Te Ching were certainly affected by his Zen practice. And he writes this. People usually think of Lao Tzu as a hermit, a dropout from society. But it's clear from his teachings that he cared deeply about society, if that means the welfare of fellow human beings. The myth perception may arise from his assistance on Wei Wu Wei, literally doing nothing, which has been seen as passivity. Nothing could be further from the truth. A good athlete can enter a state of body awareness in which the right stroke or the right movement happens by itself, effortlessly, without any interference of the conscious will. This is a paradigm for non-action, the purest and most effective form of action. The game plays the game. The poem writes the poem. And we cannot tell the dancer from the dance. As Lao Tzu puts it, less and less do you need to force things until finally you arrive at non-action. When nothing is done, nothing is left undone. Nothing is done because the doer has wholeheartedly vanished into the deed. The fuel has been completely transformed into flame. This nothing is, in fact, everything. It happens when we trust the intelligence of the universe in the same way that an athlete or dancer trusts the superior intelligence of the body. Hence Lao Tzu's emphasis on softness. Softness means the opposite of rigidity and is synonymous with suppleness, adaptability, endurance. Anyone who has seen a Tai Chi or a Keto master doing, not doing, will know how powerful the softness is. So, one of these sort of studies in paradox, right? In Taoism, the way is expressed graphically, as you know, as this disc that has these two double discs within it. They look kind of like two teardrops embracing each other, and so the depiction is about these forces of yang and yin, the assertive, the penetrative, and the receptive, or the passive, the non-doing. So they're usually characterized or pictured in this way as being two forces in balance. But, in the writings, like the writings of Lao Tzu, it may be that graphic doesn't really quite tell the full story, because it might be that a better depiction would be something more like a target, right? With the doing inside the being. So like he's saying in his text, this field, it's this field of being that informs the doing. So it's the two being in communication with each other that makes it possible for wise action to happen. So understood in this way, the state of being is the refuge. The Dharma field, the Buddha field, the realm of wisdom and compassion is the ground out of which appropriate action emerges. So like when Bhante Analayo talks about sati or mindfulness, you know, Pali is a gendered language, and sati is a female noun. Being mindful is a female verb, and so he makes reference to that. He says, you know, to be mindful is to be like a caring parent at a playground, where you create a watchful environment within which the doing of the growing being can occur. So rather than being 50-50 yin-yang, you know, it's more like the yin being the state of consciousness or the state of being that knows when the action that's being contemplated or that's being taken is wise and when it's not. And so that's the nature of self-refuge, as the Buddha taught it. He said, I found the ancient city. I found it to be available for me. It's available for you as well. You know, but it's your city. It's for you to find it. So I'd like to stop there for a few moments and just see whether anything I've said sort of rings a bell or raises a question for you. How does it affect your understanding of how things are? Please. Always most helpful if you can unmute before speaking. Any questions or comments or reflections? Okay.
Well, Lloyd?
Please, Luke. Right.
Hey. Well, I've been doing this for a while, so when I think back, I was, you know, in the beginning, was just trying to figure out how to do it, you know, the doing like you talked about, and now, you know, I try and focus more on the depth of the practice. I also fight when, you know, with challenges of dullness at times when I sit.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, that hindrance is probably my primary one. But when I'm alert, I try and focus more on the depth of it rather than the doing like I did in the beginning, trying to figure it out, you know. Yeah,
good. Right, yeah. Yeah, that one, that hindrance arises for me sometimes. Also, there's a skittishness sometimes in my practice. The mind is flitting around doing this and that, planning away like crazy. And the understanding behind obsessive activities of mind, in Buddha Dharma is that there is something that wants to be seen that the mind is disinclined to view. So for instance, for those of us who are inveterate planners, oftentimes what's behind that is fear or anxiety. The idea being that if you try to plan ahead for every eventuality, everything that might possibly happen, that it might have the effect of preventing future harm or future dukkha, right? So it's a way to try to ward off the unpleasant in the future by trying to plan for it, right? Oftentimes, if there's that dullness or just that disinclination to do it, right, then sometimes what that can mean is, yeah, there's maybe something there that could use a closer look, but it's not ready to manifest itself. It's a little like doing the archaeological dig, right? And so you're doing the dig, and then you get tired, and the sun's hot, and you want to take a break. and so you do, and then after a while, you pick up your trowel and your sieve, and you get back to it again. And so, like Ajahn Chah says, well, you know, it moves at its own pace. All you really need to do is show up, and then eventually, whatever it is that needs to be seen will come into view. Yeah.
I'm not sure I understood one of the points you were making about Taoism. And I was wondering, it sounded like you were saying that Taoism, that Zen incorporated Taoism into its Buddhist practice. Did I hear that correctly?
Basically, the lineage of the practice or the tradition is the admixture, the intertwining of, the intermingling of the Buddhist teachings on deep samadhi, okay, in Zen, the name of the practice is Shikantaza, and the Vipassana meditation, it's the awareness of the rising and passing of all phenomena, okay, without trying to do anything about them. So that Xuan Buddhism was essentially the joining together of the teachings of Taoism with the Buddhist teachings of mindful and awareness of the arising and passing of all phenomena. And it was the mixture of those two that came up with this new form of Buddhism in China called Xuan Buddhism. Okay, so those two joining together created this new tradition of Xuan Buddhism, which in Japan became known as Zen. Over the last 1600 years or so, some controversy around whether Zen is Buddhism or not. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's referred to as Zen Buddhism, sometimes it's just referred to as Zen. Some Zen masters don't claim it to be a form of Buddhism, but they teach the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, right? But they place much, much more emphasis just on bare awareness and seeing what the mind produces. A little bit like the fussing in the 19th and 20th centuries, to some extent even today, as to whether Mormonism is a bona fide form of Christianity. You know, so they follow the teachings of Jesus, except there's some stuff in there about this possible contact with extraterrestrials and the American Indian tribes being the lost tribes of Israel, and things that you don't really find in, you know, the King James Version of the Bible. So they're generally acknowledged to be, you know, a Christian denomination. Kind of like that was in.
Yeah. Lloyd, what did Taoism contribute to Buddhism? How did it change Buddhist practice in Zen?
Good question. So reading the Tao Te Ching, reading the Xuanzi, what we find is that the teachings about emptiness, the teachings about non-being, the teachings about aligning oneself with the way of nature are all there. I mean, they're all pretty well embedded in Chinese culture and practice. You know, at least one school of thought and philosophy and practice, you know, that's exclusively rooted in nature. Okay. And that was already there when Buddhadharma came along. And so what the mixture of the two did was to ground Buddhadharma in nature and to see them as being synonymous, right? So when you hear phrases like Buddha nature, or Buddha mind, okay, in the Mahayana and Zen, it's this understanding that nature is where the Dharma comes from. Just like, you know, tree roots resulting in the growth of the tree, right? So it's like, this is where the Dharma came from. It didn't come out of thin air. It didn't spring from the mind of the Buddha. It's kind of like, that's why I was reading the parable of the ancient city, because he comes as close to that point of view as anywhere in his teachings, to say it was there all along, right? Whereas in the Theravada tradition, there is much more emphasis on the teachings of dispassion and on not allowing oneself to become too engrossed in the ways of the world because of the likelihood of attachment and of being insufficiently removed from the pleasures of the world to attain enlightenment. So it's a different idea about how the enlightened state is achieved. The Taoist poets and the Xuan Buddhist poets, like Li Po, Wang Po, they like to have a good time. They party, they drank wine, they appreciated every aspect of being alive. Theirs was not the path of restraint. Theirs was not the path of asceticism, where in Southern Buddhism, it's much more about self-discipline. It's much more about guarding against the pleasures of the flesh, prohibiting the possibility of enlightenment from occurring. So it's a pretty significant break from where at least the Theravada crowd has come from. I hope that's responsive.
That would be interesting. That's a very interesting distinction. I never thought about that before. Thank you.
Yeah, right. Okay. Other thoughts or reflections? Please, Gloria. Unmute. There you go.
Different images in my mind, and I think they're all related, but I'm not sure. I was imagining or seeing the moment in the octopus film where after months and months and months of cautious circling, the octopus places her tentacles on his chest.
Yes.
And then what came up was a revelation of the hidden city. And then, for some reason, I was thinking of Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac and how he just returned every summer and sat there. You know, it's so different than the traditional Western process where he would go back with his notebook and camera and actively try to acquire knowledge, but he didn't do that. And so he got so much more back. He got the revelation of the land ethic. And it sounds like the natural world reveals itself when you let yourself be a certain way.
Bingo. Just that. Just being with it and watching carefully to see what it has to teach. I'm going to put up a reference right now that's right on point in terms of what you just said. Suzanne Simard is a forest ecologist at the University of British Columbia. And she went to forestry school back in the 1970s at around the same time I was getting an undergraduate degree in conservation of natural resources at Berkeley and taking some courses in the forestry school. And there was a real upheaval and a lot of ferment in the study of the natural world at that time. My degree was in conservation natural resources. It was in the College of Natural Resources, but we were right then at that point in time, 1972, I guess it was, ecology was a controversial elective course that was taught at Cal by an untenured instructor because it went against the grain of the vast majority of all research in biology that was being done at the time, which was the study of individual species and their surroundings, whereas ecology was the study of the entire system, how things are. And I would take courses, the courses I took in the forestry school, most of the major research in the forestry school and all the endowed chairs were paid for by Weyerhaeuser and Georgia Pacific. And so they were calling the shots in terms of the research agenda. And it was how to get the most bang for the buck in terms of forest management, whether private forests or national forests. So what was all the rage at the time is going in and cutting down every living thing in a forest, clear cutting, just wipe out everything, take out all the trees, and then come back in and plant trees like a corn crop. You know, first they would genetically engineer the trees so they'd grow as fast as possible, and they'd go out there and stick thousands of them in the ground in the clear cut. And then there were all of them started to die. And so what they would go in and do is spray them with fertilizer and pesticides or herbicides, right, in order to grow trees like you would corn. At the same time, what Suzanne Simard was out there doing, she was working for the logging industry, and she'd go out and she'd see all these plantations, you know, where the seedlings put in after clear cuts all dying off, and which inevitably led to the fertilizer and the pesticides, the herbicides. But what she was doing was studying the soil, and what she discovered that was completely against everything that was being taught in forestry school at the time, was that the trees were connected by mycorrhizal fungi. And these fungi acted like a nervous system. And the whole forests, and she talked about families of trees, there being an elder tree and a younger tree, and that as the seedlings were growing, the parent trees, the mother trees, would send out moisture through the mycorrhizal fungi. They would send out food, they would send out water and minerals, right, to help the sustain the young. And then as the young grew bigger and stronger and the older tree faltered, then they would do things the other way. And that they were capable of sending each other chemical messages, like if one tree somewhere in the forest is being attacked by a pathogen of some kind, a parasite or whatever, then they would send out a chemical message warning the other trees, and the other trees would start secreting chemicals to ward off the infection. So at any rate, she was coming up just by observing, just by, you know, going and digging up the soil in healthy forests. That's the hypothesis that she came up with. And with somebody whose research has the potential to turn everything on its head, first they simply ignore them. And of course, she was among the first women in the forest industries, and so she was easy to ignore. And then she started doing research with the money that she was getting a little bit from the government, and the research began to confirm where she was coming from. And so the next step, when somebody's research is, you know, becomes well grounded and well respected and starts to gain steam, is that it began to pose a real perceived threat to the forest industries in terms of the way they like to manage not only their own land, but the public's land as well. So then they started to ridicule her. You know, say, there's Suzanne out there, the boonies eating the wrong mushrooms and dancing with the wood fairies, and really, really ostracizing her, really doing everything possible to discouraged the development of her career, but she kept on trucking and kept on getting more research done. And all this began to happen around the same time that environmentalists were challenging clear cutting in the courts, the federal courts, you know, using endangered species as a way to slow things up. And eventually what happened is that there was more and more and more verification of her research that said what you should never clear cut a forest, should go in and do selective cutting, you know, that to replicate nature, to replicate the fires that used to come through. It's a lower yield, but it's a sustainable harvest and it keeps the forest healthy. And so she was coming up with more and more scientific evidence to show that clear cutting was a terrible idea and should not be allowed. And gradually, as a result of her research and all the lawsuits, the Forest Service started to pull back on, and eventually, in parts of the country, stop allowing clear cutting on the public lands. And so her book is the story of her research mixed in with a memoir, but it's exactly what Gloria was talking about. You know, instead of this massively intrusive industrial mode of doing, of manipulating the forest for the sole purpose of trying to get out more saleable timber, looking at the forest as a whole and seeing what constitutes a healthy forest when it's out there just on its own. And what she discovered has revolutionized the way public forests are managed, much to the consternation of the forest products industry. And she's played a major role in radically cutting back on the amount of clear cutting allowed on the American forests. Not so much, unfortunately, in her home country of Canada. They're still clear cutting the bejesus out of the softwood forests in northern Canada, because it's, you know, it's, there's more Canadian lumber being used in U.S. construction than there is American timber, except for that which is coming out of the private forests, the warehouses, and the. But it's just that doing and being. So she was practicing the study of being, you know, of manipulating the forest as little as possible for a sustained yield and also for a sustained habitat for all the other species that are completely wiped out by clear cutting. So it's a remarkable story. I really, really recommend the book to you if you like nature writing. Peggy?
I put in the chat, Tara Lloyd, a novel by Richard Powers called The Overstory, which has a character that's based on Smart and other nine other characters. And the whole gist of the book is about the trees and the forest and all of the earth, in fact, as sentient beings that communicate with one another and on, much of what you said about the rhizomes and so on. Anyway, it's a very powerful novel that links the high-tech social media world with the world like Smart's. So for people who read novels and really want to get into this, it's about some tree huggers in Oregon and Washington and California and what happens over from, say, the 60s to the 2000s. So anyway, it's another powerful take on this view of all things connected and tied and growing together and communicating together. And so I really urge people, it's a little tedious in places, but the degree to which it gets us thinking about this incredible balance, you know, it goes back to Taoism, Buddhism, Xuan Buddhism, all, I urge people to think about reading it.
Yeah, good, thank you. So a few other comments I wanted to make about the Buddha's teachings on refuge. When he was coming up on 80 years of age, he predicted that he was going to die in 3 months. And the story usually goes that he died of food poisoning from eating some, you know, blinky pork. But for, you know, medical anthropologists and others who read the discourses about the Buddha's last months, it looks like it was probably a lot more complicated than that. He probably had chronic intestinal adhesions, and his intestines were becoming progressively less able to adequately digest food. And it was some, you know, a blinky meal that probably put him over the edge. But he knew for about 3 months that he was on the way out. And so what he did during that time is he went on kind of a farewell tour. He went to the various meditation centers in the general part of the country where he lived, where his followers had set up monasteries and schools and, you know, clinics and whatnot. And these places that he would visit, he would ride circuit, you know, or walk circuit over the years to offer teachings at various of them. So he went around and made one final tour, and he kind of let everybody know this was going to be it. And then when he got close to the end, he was gathering those closest to him who he most trusted to carry his teachings on. One of his closest ally, his assistant, his cousin, the one who knew him best, and had taken care of him all of his teaching life, is Ananda. And Ananda was so grief-stricken with the Buddha's impending death that he had gone to his hut, and he was just alone there grieving deeply. And so the Buddha said, "Where's Ananda?" He looked around, and he said, "Oh, he's back in his hut. He's too moved to be able to come here." He said, "Oh, please send for him." And so he sent somebody, and they said, "Ananda, the Buddha wants to see you." And he said, I feel really embarrassed because I'm so grief-stricken and I'm not supposed to be. Because all that arises passes away, yada, yada." So I said, "No, the Buddha really wants to see you." And so he went to where the Buddha was and told him of his embarrassment, you know, because he knew he wasn't supposed to be feeling grief. And the Buddha said, "You know, don't be concerned about feeling that you need to be other than how you are." He said, "If there is grief, there is grief. And then when there is not, there is not." And he said, I will be gone soon, but those of you who fear that you will be unable to continue to follow the path in my absence need to be assured that you can, you know, if in fact, you know, you're sorry to see me go as a friend goes, you know, that's one thing. But if what you're grieving is the fear of your inability to continue on the path to awakening, that should not be feared." Because, you know, he kind of referring back to, he didn't refer exactly to the parable of this, of the ancient city, but what he did say was this, you know, at the end of that, in the Monty Python movie, The Life of Brian, you know, where it's loosely patterned on the life of Jesus. And there's this one, I think my favorite scene in the movie is when he's standing at the back of the crowd during the Sermon on the Mount. And everyone, and the people in the back of the crowd can't quite make out what Jesus is saying, you know, when he's talking, you know, to be a lamp unto the earth and, you know, blessed are the peacemakers and all that. And so he keeps asking, what do you say? And the guy in front of him turns around and says, "I think he said, blessed are the cheesemakers." He says, "Oh, well, you know, it's good food if you don't eat too much, you know. And then people are saying, "But what about the other dairy products?" You know, so it was this not quite getting it right in terms of what he said. when the Buddha was dying, you know, he's talking to Ananda and others, he used the word dipa. Dipa is a Pali word that can be translated either as lamp or as island. And you'll find translations of the Parinibbana Sutta, this great long story of the Buddha's final passing, that translate it in both ways. So I think the Thomas Byron translation says, advising people to be ye lamps unto yourselves, but take to yourself no other lamp, you know. And that kind of jived with Christian notions of, you know, like Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount, you know, be a lamp unto the world and whatnot. In fact, there's one of the Theosophists put out this famous book toward the beginning of the 20th century about the Buddha, called The Light of Asia. Another translation, be islands unto yourselves. That one didn't go over so good with the British translators because of poems like John Donne's, you know, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a part of the main, a piece of the whole. Never therefore send a note for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. But that, and more Pali scholars these days seem to think he probably did mean island. But when he was talking about island in that context, he wasn't talking like in the cartoon, it's like a little sand spit in the middle of the Pacific with a one palm tree. The understanding was that he was talking about an island. He was talking about an island like Sri Lanka or Madagascar, you know, just a substantial landmass that has everything needed to sustain life, that has fresh water and fruit and all the means of sustenance to make one's way, right? And that is indeed what he was trying to convey. He said, everything you need to complete the path to freedom and to full awakening is already on board. You already have it, right? You don't need me. You know, I've left my teachings behind. In fact, among the more well-known symbols that you'll find in different, especially Southern Buddhist countries, of the Buddha is a footprint, like a footprint in the sand or a footprint in stone, right? Meaning he was here, thus gone. He was here and left this empty space, right? And so what he was trying to convey at his time of, you know, around the time of his death is, don't fear my going. You know, if what that means is you're afraid you won't be able to awaken, you know, because your awakening does not depend upon me. It depends upon your continued exploration of your own refuge, of your own state of inner being, because everything you need for awakening is there waiting to be discovered. And it's discovered by the process of being with the essence of who you are in a clear, calm, and accepting way. Like Gloria was saying, you know, being with oneself in an open-hearted way is the kind of refuge that will make final liberation possible. Not dependent on a particular teaching, not dependent on a particular person or leader, but only dependent on your ever deepening knowledge and discovery of what's within. So that's the teaching. More questions or reflections? Okay. Well, my friends, that being the case, I guess we can go our separate ways. Blessed are the cheesemakers. So let's settle in for just a moment. Find our sitting posture once more and allow the eyes to gently close. Do you have the patience to wait until your mud settles and the water is clear? Can you remain unmoving until the right action arises by itself? The master does not seek fulfillment. Not seeking, not expecting, you can be present and welcome all things. Have a good week, everybody.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Eat your cheese, but in moderation.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd. What would you like to call your talk?
Let's call it self-refuge, colon, doing and being.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks.
Be well, everybody.